The client perception and demand for pain management has skyrocketed over the last several years. So I think it is a veterinarian and veterinary technician responsibility to recognize pain and to treat it properly. The best way to treat pain, if any of you have attended any of the other pain sessions, is to give preemptive analgesia or to give pain medication before the pain is there, because that's more effective. There's question whether we should be calling pain the fourth vital sign, with temperature, heart rate, respiration being the first three. In human medicine, the fourth vital sign is considered blood pressure, but we don't really do that all that often or routinely on our normal patients. And so they call pain the fifth vital sign in human medicine. And so I guess I sort of think of it as the fourth vital sign these days. Especially because it's part of the 2003 AAHA Standards of Accreditation Quality of Care. And you can find these online, the whole set of guidelines that we're required, if you're in an AAHA certified hospital, to include pain assessment as part of your physical exam, as well as part of a daily assessment of that animal. There are many categories for pain recognition. There are many pain scales. There are many different ways to evaluate pain in animals. These are the six big categories. In my proceedings, I break these down into more specifics between dogs and cats and how they exhibit themselves. I don't really have time to go through all of that today. But vocalization, changes in temperament, obvious changes in posture, such as the praying position, especially when we're talking about visceral pain, mobility changes, you know, if a dog is limping, inappetence, and then obviously physical exam abnormalities that might suggest sympathetic nerve stimulation, which can be associated with pain. These are the six big categories I think of when I'm trying to recognize pain. It's important to realize that just because an animal isn't showing pain does not mean that it is not in pain. There's been some videotape studies that have shown that animals hide pain when people are around, because they're, especially dogs, because they're very social animals. And if you videotape some of these animals by themselves when there aren't people around, that they tend to exhibit pain when if we were just looking at them directly, we wouldn't think they were painful because they're hiding it because they're being socially interactive with us. So my rule of thumb is if you think it would hurt you, then treat the animal as if it hurts. As far as preemptive analgesia goes, this, as I mentioned, is the concept that treating pain prior to inducing pain prevents something called the wind-up phenomenon. This means that when we don't treat pain and all the pain pathways are already stimulated, they tend to go a little haywire, and they can stimulate even more pain and make an animal actually hyperalgesic. So if we can, again, get that pain before it starts, we're going to be more successful in treating that animal's pain, and it's more easy to control and it's more effective, especially postoperatively. When we talk about managing pain, and this is important for both visceral and somatic pain, we want to block the pain pathway. And there are really five big areas of pain. There's transduction, which is where the source of the pain starts, the noxious stimulus. Then there's transmission up to the spinal cord. There's modulation in the spinal cord. There's projection to the cortex of the brain. And then there's perception and going back down the spinal tracts. There are, when we're talking about treatment of pain, I find it easy to look at these five categories and say, if I can block 1, 2, 3, or all five of the pain pathways, I'm going to have more effective pain management because I'm using different modalities of treating that pain. And so I kind of like to keep that schematic in mind. That leads me to the concept of multimodal pain relief, that using different drugs that target different areas of those pain pathways is more effective in controlling pain than one single pain relief agent. So for instance, I have ketamine, morphine, and NSAIDs up here, and the NSAIDs are going to target that initial transduction area so where the inflammatory mediators are. And then the morphine and ketamine are going to work more at the spinal cord level and the cortex level. So you're blocking several pain pathways there. So when we're specifically talking about visceral pain, we're talking about what's going on inside. Not the muscles, not the skin, but the organs typically. So we're looking at bowel, the liver, anything to do with the pancreas. We know pancreatic pain can be some of the most painful conditions in people. Kidney pain, you talk to anybody who's tried to pass a kidney stone, how painful that is. Uterine pain, such as labor, and then mesenteric and peritoneal pain that we may feel, or our patients may feel when we have something like a peritonitis going on. But we can't forget the thoracic viscera, too. And this is something that I'm not sure we recognize as much when we truly just have thoracic visceral pain. You can have pain from heart attacks, and we don't see that very often in small animals. Probably birds are the most likely to have this. But you talk about people who have heart attacks, and they get pain referred down their arm. They have shortness of breath, and they have discomfort. And that's all because of the visceral pain pathways. Vascular pain, such as thromboembolic disease, pain associated with lung disease, esophageal disease, or pleuritis, which again can be very painful. So this little dog, you can tell, is not feeling very well, got attacked by another dog in the abdomen here, grabbed and shook. And just looking at the animal's posture, heads down, hunched over, these are the postural changes we're looking at. I think you can appreciate that this dog is probably painful. And there's probably a combination here of somatic pain because the abdominal wall has been disrupted here. So the muscle and the skin are going to be painful. And then the question is this mesentery that is hanging out of the dog causing the dog discomfort as well? And that's hard to say, but probably. This is another example of a dog that I would say is painful. Came in for a hemoabdomen, actually, but she was very stable, and this is just her being very stoic, and she apparently wasn't a normally stoic dog, according to the owners. And if my belly was that big, she actually just had a hemangioma on her spleen, but I think that distension of the abdomen and that the tumor on the spleen that was so incredibly big was probably causing her visceral pain and just general malaise and not feeling well. So when you talk to people about what visceral pain is, they describe it very differently than somatic pain. If you hit yourself on the finger with a hammer, you're going to say, ouch, and it's going to have a very sharp pain, and you're going to feel it right away. Whereas when you have visceral pain, it's more of a dull and aching, just kind of a nagging, boring pain. You can't sometimes localize it really well. And there's a lot of individual variation in people of how this is manifested. Interestingly, there's a lot of systemic signs associated with visceral pain as opposed to somatic pain, such as malaise, illness, vomiting, nausea, and then even restlessness. And one of the most unique things about visceral pain is its ability to cause referred pain. I referred to the heart attack situation in people. You get this referred pain down your arm, and we're going to just talk about that briefly as to why visceral pain can lead to referred pain sometimes. The systemic response to visceral pain is similar to somatic pain. It stimulates the autonomic nervous system, so therefore in animals that can sweat, you're going to see sweating. It's going to cause vasomotor responses and changes in blood pressure and changes in heart rate. So these are the objective things that we can look for. Interestingly, the causes of visceral pain are very different than causes of somatic pain. And I normally think of this when we're thinking of like an intestine. If an intestine is very distended or spasming and we're stretching it, like the ligaments that are stretched in a GDV, if we have ischemia or necrosis to an area from thromboembolic disease, inflammation such as pancreatitis, any compression of ligaments and vessels, and then algesic substances such as peritonitis, all of these can cause visceral pain. Interestingly, cutting, crushing, clamping, and burning the viscera does not cause pain. You can actually do that to an intestine or an organ, and when you're cutting it out or doing a resection and anastomosis, and that is not the cause of the visceral pain. And so it again is that spasming and that distension and some of the other things that we mentioned in the previous slide that causes visceral pain, and as opposed to somatic pain. So why is visceral pain different than somatic pain? And this goes back to a little bit of anatomy, but it has to do with the fact that the number of what we call A fiber or myelinated pain fibers to C fiber, which are unmyelinated, ratios are very different. And those C fibers that are unmyelinated transmit the pain very, very slowly. It's not like that sharp pain. So if you had a lot of A fibers, which you do to your skin and to muscle and bone, that's going to be transmitted very quickly because a lot of those are going up the A fibers, and you're going to feel that right away. And there's going to be very little delay. Whereas you have 8 to 10 times more C fibers innervating your viscera than you do your A fibers. So therefore, visceral pain primarily stimulates the C polymodal receptors of these unmyelinated nerves, and it's transmitted very slowly and probably leads to some of that dull, just kind of boring, aching type pain. There's also a lot fewer visceral afferents, so there's fewer nerves in general going from all of these organs than there are for cutaneous afferents. So, you know, for one little piece of skin, we probably have a pain receptor, whereas for multiple organs, we have one nerve as opposed to the skin. Most of the visceral pain pathways follow the vagus nerve, the splanchnic nerve, and the pelvic and hypogastric nerves, which are associated with the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems. And then they course through the sympathetic ganglion on their way up to the spinal cord and to the brain. And I don't expect you to be able to read this, but what I want to get out of this is that this nerve here, this long one here, this is a view of the parasympathetic nervous system on your left and the sympathetic nervous system on your right. The vagus nerve here, which I said a lot of the visceral pain pathways course with, innervates all of the thoracic viscera, the heart, the lungs, as well as the stomach and intestines. So there's a lot of interaction between all of these things, and you could see why some of this causes referred pain. I also said the pelvic and hypogastric nerves are coursing with the visceral pain afferents, and so we're looking at kidneys, uterus, bladder, down there. And then they also go with the splanchnic nerves, which is the sympathetic side of things, but looking at a lot of the abdominal viscera associated with those. So again, a lot of organs go to one nerve. In addition to only having one nerve for a lot of organs, those nerves then converge in the spinal cord onto what are called second-order neurons. And these neurons are either somatic or viscerosomatic, so they're combination second nerves. And this convergence leads to referred pain and poor localization, and then it ascends in the spinal tract. And the spinal cord segment that receives the visceral stimulus may then, because it's stimulating these second order neurons, it may stimulate a dermatome, which is for the skin, a sclerotome, which is for bone, or a myotome, which is for muscle. And this is from Gaynor and Muir's veterinary pain management book. But it's a nice illustration. We start with some sort of spasming here in the stomach or some sort of insult to the stomach. And this goes up through the sympathetic ganglion to the spinal cord. And this is the spinal cord right here. And then this, again, it converges on more than one neuron. So it goes back to the stomach and causes spasming and sphincter closure and vasoconstriction. But it also stimulates skeletal muscle contraction as well as increased sympathetic activity in the skin, which ultimately then causes even more pain receptors to be released. And those then kind of wind up the system, and you're going to get even more pain responses going up to the brain. So this is why referred pain occurs in visceral pain. So I guess the big question is visceral pain treated differently than somatic pain? And that may be why a lot of you are here. And unfortunately, we don't have all that many choices of pain, drug categories that we can choose from when treating either visceral or somatic pain. These are the five big categories that I always think of when I'm thinking about trying to treat an animal in pain. I think of the opioids, the local anesthetics, ketamine, alpha-2 agonists such as metatomidine, and the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories. And it's no different really between visceral and somatic pain as far as this approach goes. There is some evidence that visceral pain may be more responsive to kappa opioid agonists as opposed to mu agonists. The most commonly used kappa agonist in veterinary medicine is butorphanol. The problem with butorphanol is that it's very short-acting. Most of the recent studies have shown that the analgesic effects of butorphanol only last 30 to 90 minutes. And if you look it up in Plum or some other veterinary drug book, a lot of times it says to give butorphanol every 4 to 6 hours for pain. Well, that's not going to be effective. And sometimes you might think that the pain is working because the sedative effects of butorphanol tend to last longer than the analgesic effects. And so the sedative effects may be masking some of that pain. And sedation does help in pain management. It makes the animal less aware that the pain is going on, but it's not preventing those pain pathways from still being stimulated, which again makes the pain control more difficult. It's also, at least here in Colorado, very expensive to use as a constant rate infusion. So when I give butorphanol, unless I'm just using it for a short sedation, I use it as a constant rate infusion because of its short analgesic half-life. But in a large dog, at least at CSU, I'd say like a 50-kilo dog, if we put them on a butorphanol CRI, it would be close to $200 a day. So that doesn't work very well in some of these animals. So therefore, we tend to use a lot of the mu agonists. So these are like the pure opioid, the hydromorphone, the oxymorphone, the morphines. And we use these despite the fact that visceral pain supposedly is more responsive to kappa opioid agonism. And I have to say that personally, I see animals respond to these mu agonists pretty effectively. But if I have the opportunity, I will use butorphanol frequently. The only other kappa agonist we have is nalbuphine, but I haven't used it that much for analgesic purposes. I use it mostly for partial reversal of pure opioids. So I just wanted to show you, this is a dog that I desperately wanted to get its pain under control. You can see she's just laying here in lateral recumbency and she's shivering. She's taking deep breaths. She's sitting in the praying position. This dog is on a butorphanol CRI right now. All she has is vomiting and diarrhea. And she has no evidence of pancreatitis. This is all pain from the intestines being inflamed and stretched and spasming. And I had to switch this dog to a mu agonist, like a fentanyl CRI, in order to control her pain. So, you know, even though theoretically the kappas are better, I've had to go to mu receptors sometimes to help control the pain. I think part of the problem is that butorphanol has a ceiling effect. So once you reach the maximum dose, giving more doesn't cause more analgesia. It just sort of causes more sedation. So I think that's one of the problems with it. Some other things we can do for visceral pain, though, that we don't talk a lot about is epidural pain management. Because of the fact that a lot of those visceral pain afferent pathways course through the pelvic and hypogastric nerves, we can block a lot of those caudal abdominal organs like the kidney and bladder and uterus with an opioid and local anesthetic epidural. You also can control upper abdominal pain because you're going to then start getting some of those splanchnic nerve innervations that are going to the spinal cord with what I use is opioid-only epidurals. I take the local anesthetic out of them. I don't use bupivacaine because if you get too high of an epidural and you have a local anesthetic in it, you can cause intercostal nerve depression and you can interfere with ventilation. Whereas the opioid in and of itself shouldn't cause motor blockade to the intercostal nerves. So you can control upper abdominal pain. I've controlled pancreatitis cases fairly effectively with epidurals, opioid-only epidurals. Upper abdominal pain, again, we're talking liver, stomach, and pancreas, may be treated with intrapleural blocks. And I'm going to go back to that one slide real quick to show you how that works. And then thoracic pain can be treated with intercostal or intrapleural blocks when we're talking about treating visceral pain. And again, I don't expect you to see this, but this is real clearly, but this is the thoracic vertebrae segments right here, and we have the lumbar vertebrae segments down here. And the splanchnic nerves come in all through the thoracic, and the splanchnic nerves actually innervate a lot of the upper abdominal organs, such as the liver, spleen, and pancreas, and stomach. So if you can block some of these thoracic segments, you're going to actually get upper abdominal pain relief. And that's why the intrapleural blocks actually work in treating abdominal pain. So in summary of how to treat it, I would go with systemic opioids, kappa receptors such as butorphanol or the mu receptors, whatever you have available, I think are pretty equally effective. Local anesthetics also can be instilled directly into the abdomen, especially for pancreatitis cases. Now, this is controversial because if there's a lot of inflammation going on, it changes the pH of the abdominal fluid, and local anesthetics are pH dependent on their ability to work. And so they may not be as effective, and if there's a lot of fluid in there, it will dilute out your local anesthetic. And so some animals respond very effectively to just instilling, you know, local anesthetic directly into the abdominal cavity, and some don't. Low-dose parenteral lidocaine, so IV lidocaine as a constant rate infusion, very common these days, very good in as an adjunct pain management with the other opioids. I think it's great for visceral pain. It also has been shown to increase GI motility, which may be useful in certain situations, especially like pancreatitis cases. And it has been shown to decrease the systemic inflammatory response syndrome, which again, for a pancreatitis animal, that might be very ideal, or even a pyothorax animal, which is very prone to getting systemic inflammation and sepsis. Low-dose ketamine, so we're talking microdose ketamine, and I have doses listed in your proceedings for these. Very effective, blocks the NMDA receptor at the level of the spinal cord and helps prevent that wind-up phenomenon. Are NSAIDs effective in visceral pain? Probably not nearly as effective as somatic pain. I think this is probably the biggest difference is that I just don't think that the NSAIDs are as effective in this sense because inflammation in and of itself isn't really the sole cause of the pain in a lot of circumstances. In some circumstances, they are. Low-dose metatomidine. So again, microdoses of metatomidine. I use 1 to 3 micrograms per kilo per hour of metatomidine. And again, this is, works at the level of the spinal cord and the brain because it causes some sedation and is very effective in addition to lidocaine and opioids for pain management. You have to keep in mind that the cardiovascular effects of metatomidine are still present even at the microdoses. So you're going to get potentially vasoconstriction, bradycardia, hypotension. So you have to be cautious in who you use it with. And then peritoneal lavage may be very effective if there's a lot of inflammation going on in the belly. So I'm going to go through some case examples of how I would treat some cases of visceral pain. Our first case is a 6-year-old male castrated Great Dane with a 6-hour history of non-productive retching. Their diagnosis is a GDV. So when we're talking about the considerations for pain management in this dog, we definitely want to treat visceral pain because we know it's present. The stomach is twisted. We have ligament stretching. We have distension of the stomach. We probably have some necrosis going on in certain situations. So we'd like to give something parenterally or IV for pain, as well as something for anxiety. But in this case, the animal is in shock or is in compensatory shock, so we need to try and give something that's cardiopulmonary sparing. So I would consider something called a neuroleptic analgesia, which is an opioid mixed with a sedative. That's what a neuroleptic analgesia is. This will help both with pain, anxiety, and may help us pass the stomach tube. As far as the sedatives go, which the benzodiazepines are the most cardiopulmonary sparing, the other two categories to choose from would be acepromazine or the alpha-2 agonists such as metatomidine. Of those, I would choose the benzodiazepines in this dog because it's the most cardiopulmonary sparing and it's reversible. I also would choose a pure opioid in this dog, such as hydromorphone, because it will allow me to reverse it if necessary with naloxone, and it also allows me to use a lot of the intraoperative opioids that I like to use, are pure opioids like a fentanyl CRI. So in this dog, I start with low doses. I always titrate to effect. I would start with low-dose hydromorphone and kind of middle-of-the-road Valium dose IV. I think just in general, considerations for a patient that's in shock or compensatory shock, use of reversible drugs, cardiopulmonary sparing drugs, titrate them to effect, monitor vitals closely, and then I would avoid non-steroidals, acepromazine, and alpha-2 agonists in a shock state. Intraoperatively and postoperatively for this dog, I would probably do a fentanyl constant rate infusion. You wouldn't have to do that. You could give a long-lasting pure opioid to start with, whether that be morphine or hydromorphone as a one-time injection, and then continue that postoperatively. I would consider a lidocaine CRI because of its anti-inflammatory properties and its help with reperfusion injury. Low dose, 20 to 30 micrograms, actually, for the pain dose. You'll still get the pain dose if you're up at the antiarrhythmic dose, which is up at the 75 mic per kilo per minute. And then if that wasn't effective, I would consider low-dose ketamine CRI. I just find that ketamine tends to be better for bone and muscle pain and that lidocaine is better for visceral pain. So if I was to add something to an opioid, my first choice would probably be a lidocaine CRI. If I was trying to choose between, you know, what do I do next? Do I do lidocaine? Do I do ketamine? Do I do metatomidine? I would probably choose lidocaine first. Case number 2, 4-year-old female intact mixed breed dog. She's in active labor for 2 hours. One puppy is in the birth canal, and she's known to have 2 more puppies in the uterus. This is your patient. She's in distress. She's panting. She's been restless, and she's pretty exhausted. And she has a puppy that is dead, just stuck in her birth canal. So we know that visceral pain is present due to dystocia, and we also know that uterine contractions cause severe pain during labor. In women, labor is reportedly one of the most painful experiences one can have. as I can attest to, 2 months ago with my new little one. It's a very painful process, and I find it interesting that we don't really think of dogs and cats as being excruciatingly painful when they're in labor, because they don't tend to act that way. And so I don't know if they're in severe pain during labor like people are. But in people, it's definitely painful. The visceral afferents, as I mentioned, ascend with the pelvic and hypogastric nerves, and the uterus is innervated through these, and so it's very responsive to epidural analgesia. And if you're not doing epidural analgesia, then, you know, it's something to definitely consider. I would recommend, you know, if it's something you're interested in, it's a very effective means of pain management. And I'm sure that there are lots of continuing education classes. You can take lots of labs and things so you can learn how to do epidural analgesia. It's very helpful also if a cesarean is necessary. So in this situation, we want to give drugs that quickly redistribute and won't compromise the puppy, and we want to give reversible drugs again. Epidural drugs tend to have less systemic effects on fetuses than the IV drugs do. Opioids can get ion trapped in the placenta due to pH differences, but low doses are generally safe, especially if you're getting the puppies out immediately. This is probably more of a concern if you were giving opioids, you know, halfway through a pregnancy and they were going to have to be on it for a while. But even then, low doses are generally safe. If you're doing it during a C-section, you should have naloxone available to put under the tongue, a drop or two for the puppies or kittens as they come out. The local anesthetics epidurally work very well in dystocia, but frequently cause hind limb paresis and paralysis if you're using, you know, bupivacaine or lidocaine with them. This may be an issue for the bitch or the queen as far as caring for the young, so keep that in mind because they won't be able to move around very well. Epidurals also can cause urine retention, which might make the mom uncomfortable. And then animals frequently need to be immobilized in order to give them an epidural, which I think is the biggest disadvantage of trying to use epidurals in small animals. So most of the times they need to be heavily sedated or anesthetized in order to perform the epidural. Of the general anesthetics, propofol is probably the safest as long as they're volume resuscitated, because it redistributes and it doesn't accumulate, and so the puppies aren't going to be horribly affected from the propofol. If an IV pain control is needed, I would consider such hydromorphone, oxymorphone, or butorphanol in low doses. I would consider an epidural bupivacaine or morphine alone epidural. I'd consider propofol for induction. And then if a C-section is necessary, I'd probably do a line block with lidocaine. And I think this would be very effective visceral pain management, as well as some somatic pain management because of the line block with the lidocaine as you're going into the abdomen. The third case, 3-year-old female spayed calico, 2-day history of progressive dyspnea and anorexia, and your diagnosis is pyothorax. And this is more of one of those just questions that I have. I mean, I don't know how painful pyothorax is, but we certainly know that visceral pain is likely present due to pleuritis, and pleuritis in people is very, very painful. It makes it very difficult to breathe and take deep breaths. I would say that I probably don't automatically say, oh, this animal has pyothorax, he needs pain meds, versus if I knew he had peritonitis, I would say, yes, he needs pain meds. It's something that I just think that we should consider. If this is a case where you're putting chest tubes in, then you're going to have somatic pain, and we know chest tubes are very painful. So obviously a lot of these animals end up on pain medicine. But if you have an owner that can't afford chest tubes and you decide to just drain the thorax and hope for the best and start antibiotics, I guess I'm just throwing it out there whether or not it's something we should be more aggressive with in these cases. I don't really know the answer, but it's probably necessary to consider pain medications in these cases. So I would consider, especially in a cat, a low-dose butorphanol constant rate infusion or a low-dose hydromorphone constant rate infusion. You want to be cautious of respiratory depression because we're dealing with a respiratory situation. Maybe do some intrapleural local anesthetics. Again, the same problems with dilution and inflammation and making the local anesthetic less effective do apply here, but we want to be aware of the total doses used. I'd probably use a combination of lidocaine and bupivacaine. You could use just one or the other, but lidocaine works very quickly, but is short-acting, whereas bupivacaine takes a little while to work, but then lasts a lot longer. So if you use kind of a combination of them, generally around 1 mg per kg of each, then you get the immediate relief from the lidocaine and the longer-lasting relief from the bupivacaine. Fourth case, 3-year-old male castrated domestic short hair for strangeria for 48 hours with no urine production, seen for 24 hours. We diagnose urinary obstruction. So what sedation and pain protocol would be appropriate? In order to get the urinary catheter in, I would choose a neuroleptic analgesia. One of my favorites in cats is butorphanol Valium combination, and then a little bit of ketamine if I need it. You can obviously repeat all three of these drugs if you need to for more sedation, but I would like to make you aware that ketamine is excreted unchanged in the kidney of the cat. So if you're unable to unblock them, do not continue to use ketamine as your anesthetic. I think if you go up more than 4 mg per kg, and you can't get them unblocked, which happened to me once. I had a cat referred to me who had gotten a lot of ketamine, had a stricture. It was like its third time he'd reblocked, and this is a pretty rare situation. You can't get him unblocked. But he slept for like 2 days after that because he wasn't excreting his ketamine. He kept reabsorbing it. So just be aware of that. At my internship at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Lulich, who I believe is speaking opposite of me right now, and Dr. Osborne, who study lower urinary disease, have learned that urethral spasm and inflammation is probably the most common source of pain in these cats and cause for them to reblock after you pull the catheter. So it's very, very important to target the pain as well as probably target the inflammation. I'd probably consider a one-time dose of an NSAID like meloxicam. Some people use piroxicam. Some people use dexamethasone once. I just worry about using it long-term because I don't know how much kidney damage has occurred. If they've been obstructed for a long time, you're going to get back pressure into the kidney, and they might have some mild kidney damage from that. So I'd like to avoid NSAIDs if that's the case, but a one-time dose is probably fine if they're volume resuscitated. And then I would consider a butorphanol CRI or the buccal buprenorphine, which works great in cats because it's absorbed with 100% bioavailability through the gums. This doesn't work in dogs, but it works in cats because the pH of their mouth is appropriate for 100% absorption. And it's great for them to go home on this medicine, and hopefully that'll help with the spasming and the pain and prevent them from reblocking. My last case is an 8-year-old female spayed miniature schnauzer. She has a 3-day history of vomiting, and her diagnosis is severe pancreatitis. You absolutely should use a multimodal pain approach when dealing with pancreatitis, at least the severe cases, and even probably the mild cases, but I see a lot of the really severe cases, and you really need to block the pain pathway in multiple different areas. Pancreatic pain is considered one of the most painful conditions in people. Anybody you know of has had pancreatitis or pancreatic cancer, they're in excruciating pain. And I've seen dogs with severe pancreatitis, and we've euthanized them because of their pain, and I'm sure you guys have too, because there's nothing, regardless of multimodal pain management, that we can do for some of these animals. So I always use systemic opioids. Opioids are such the mainstay because they block the pain pathway in about 3 different areas to start with. So they're a wonderful single type drug. Fentanyl, hydromorphone, Ileus is an issue with pancreatitis and with opioids, so keep that in mind. I would consider a butorphanol CRI in this dog, but I find that, again, it's kind of expensive. And sometimes they actually need more potent opioid than butorphanol for this type of pain. And also has been reported morphine and meperidine to interfere with the sphincter of Oddi, which is a sphincter at the bile, at the end of the bile duct. Dogs do have a sphincter of Oddi. People definitely do. This is mostly from the human literature, but we don't know if the sphincter of Oddi is actually functional in dogs, so I'm not sure that being cautious with morphine or meperidine in these dogs is necessary. I would consider a low-dose ketamine CRI and a low-dose lidocaine CRI. If that wasn't working, I'd probably take the ketamine out and add in metatomidine CRI if the dog was cardiovascularly stable enough. And then I would consider some of the local anesthetic techniques. And you need to be aware of the toxic doses if you're using systemic lidocaine in addition to local lidocaine, but I would consider an intra-abdominal infusion of the local or an intrapleural block, which should block that upper abdominal. I would consider epidural opioid, kind of a high epidural. Anxiolytics in this case are very useful. It's not going to help stop the pain pathways, but if the animal can rest and sleep, they're going to be less aware of their pain. And then antiemetics, because I think these dogs are miserable and nausea in and of themselves can be a discomfort and add to the pain. And then I would avoid NSAIDs and steroids in this case. We think that there's an association between steroids and pancreatitis, but we're not sure. It kind of flips back and forth in the literature all the time. And non-steroidal anti-inflammatories can alter blood flow to the kidneys, and a lot of these pancreas dogs don't have the best circulation, and I'd want to maximize circulation to the kidneys as well as the pancreas. And then lastly, abdominal flushing. This is the dog with pancreatitis. This is the pancreas here running right along the duodenum. This is the duodenum in the middle. You can see it's totally black and necrosed and ischemic in this area, and the pancreas is so inflamed. We ended up euthanizing this dog on the table because we just couldn't do anything for her. But abdominal flushing a lot of times makes these animals feel a lot better. You can do this either surgically or potentially with a peritoneal catheter. So in summary, visceral pain tends to be a dull, aching, poorly localized pain. Referred pain is very common due to the afferent pathways. A question came up, Dr. Pete Hellier, who's now one of our associate deans, but he's an anesthesiologist up at CSU, asked me once, he's like, do you think sometimes animals with visceral pain come in limping because they have referred pain, you know, or holding up their leg or doing something that is showing us that we think they might have, you know, somatic pain, but really it's referred pain? And of course, we don't know the answer to that, but it's something interesting to think about. And then lastly, just like with somatic pain, a multimodal approach is very important, using a combination of both IV and local analgesic techniques is generally very effective in controlling visceral pain. And with that, it's one of our rattlesnake dogs here in Fort Collins, the pointer. But with that, I'd be happy to entertain questions. I think our time is up, so feel free to... I have five minutes. Any questions? Robin? Yes. You mean tramadol, did you say, orally? Yeah, I would think if you just have a dystocia, giving pain medication should not alter the ability for her to push and that sort of thing. It's kind of hard because you don't want to depress her to the point that she's not able to move around and that sort of thing. But I think just low doses of opioids in general, if you're very judicious about it, I don't think it would be an issue at all. In people, they would give you an epidural in that situation. So because the puppies are going to be less affected than systemic. So I don't truly know the answer to that, but it should be okay to give that if you felt the animal needed it. Yes, sir. The question is, how long do I think the morphine epidural lasts? The literature, if you're using Duramorph, which is the preservative-free morphine, which is what's recommended to give epidurally, it lasts about 12 to 24 hours. So you're good for that first time period, but if you're sending the animal home and they had a C-section, then obviously we should send them home with some oral pain medications as well to help control that. The interesting thing about the morphine epidural and why a lot of people add a local anesthetic to them is because of the way that the pH of, or the lipid solubility of morphine is different than some of the other opioids. So like if you gave fentanyl, it would be very fast acting, but it's very short acting epidurally. Whereas morphine takes about an hour or two to actually work, and then it'll last about 12 to 24 hours. That's why if you give an epidural and you're going to do a C-section or you want immediate pain relief, why people add a local anesthetic, because that will happen immediately with pain relief, and that'll only last about 4 hours if you're using bupivacaine, 4 to 6 hours, and then the morphine will last that full 12 to 24. Other questions? Yes? The question is, do I use MLK, CRIs, and that's the metatomidine, ketamine, lidocaine, or morphine, ketamine, lidocaine, CRIs. And I don't personally use MLK, but I lecture on using MLK, and I've talked to a lot of practitioners who really, really like it. The beauty of the MLK protocol is you can have everything in one bag, so you don't have to have three syringe pumps and that sort of thing. I like to have things separately because then I can control what they're getting and how much they're getting. But I think that the MLK protocol, as written by Bill Muir, is for anesthesia. So if you're going to use it just for analgesia, you should cut the rate by half or a quarter, and you're still going to probably get fairly effective analgesia for an awake state. So I think that combination is great because of that multimodal approach. I think that article that he had, which was in JAVMA, I believe, is when it was originally published in early 2000, talked about the MLK, and I think it revolutionized the veterinarian's perspective on how to do multimodal pain relief. So that's a great article. And I have the recipe up here if anybody needs it. Or I think I have it in my notes, too, the MLK. Yeah, the question is, do local anesthetics sting when you put them intrapleurally or intra-abdominally, even sub-Q? Absolutely, they sting. They hurt a lot. And so because of that, some people advocate putting one part bicarbonate to 9 parts of the local anesthetic. Bupivacaine is actually worse, I think, than lidocaine in its ability to cause stinging. So if you're having an animal severely react, I would recommend putting a little bit of bicarbonate with it. The only issue is that it may become less effective because it changes the pH of the local anesthetic. That's why it stings, is because the pH of it is so different from our body. And so if you add bicarb, it buffers it, but it may make it a little less effective. But I think most of the time in that ratio, it shouldn't make that much of a difference. It's a good question. Other questions? Great. Thank you for participating. I appreciate it.